Hi, I'm Asha Tomlinson.
And I'm David Common.
And we're hosts of CBC Marketplace. We're award-winning investigative journalists that want to help you avoid clever scams, unsafe products, and sketchy services.
Our TV show has been Canada's top investigative consumer watchdog for more than 50 years, but this is our first podcast.
CBC Marketplace podcast is available now on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
We will build a regional coalition and exact a price from Iran in a way and at a time that suits us.
Israel weighs how to respond after Iran's missile and drone attack, while Western leaders scramble to prevent things from escalating into a wider war. Welcome to Your World Tonight, this Sunday, April 14th. I'm Stephanie Skenderis. Also on the podcast, the federal government is getting set to release its budget, which will include billions of dollars to boost housing. But how does Ottawa plan to pay for its ambitious agenda? And later...
So, like, one hand at the bottom and the other hand on the side, and then frog, giraffe neck.
Basketball lessons from an Olympian in the making. Iran's weapons may have been shot down, but there is still tension in the Middle East. Israel says nearly all of the drones, missiles, and rockets were intercepted with the help of international allies. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's war cabinet met today to discuss next moves, while international diplomacy goes into overdrive to prevent a larger conflict. Senior international correspondent Margaret Evans begins our coverage tonight.
The sobering howl of Israeli air raid sirens as the long shadow war between Iran and Israel revealed itself in the skies overnight. An unprecedented Iranian attack, ultimately thwarted by Israel's air defense systems and its allies. Noga Tarnopolsky is an Israeli journalist.
Iran launched 350 or so projectiles from its sovereign territory against Israel. That is an absolute major attack.
The question now for many is whether further escalation is inevitable. Iran has described its attack as self-defense after a suspected Israeli strike on its consulate in Damascus on April 1st, killing top commanders. Some Iranians celebrated the attack on Israel on the streets in Tehran, but military officials seem to be hoping to now draw a line under it. There is no intention to continue this operation, says Iran's armed forces chief, Mohammed Bagheri. But if the Zionist regime takes any action against the Islamic Republic of Iran, our next operation will be much bigger. Tehran says it warned regional neighbors of the attacks 72 hours ahead of time and that it told Washington they would be limited. Israel promised a response even before its war cabinet had met. Benny Gantz is one of its members. We will build a regional coalition and exact a price from Iran, he says, in the timing and fashion of our choice. The U.S. President Joe Biden has urged caution on the Israeli prime minister, telling Benjamin Netanyahu in a phone call that Washington will help Israel defend itself, but that it won't take part in any retaliatory attacks against Iran. Journalist Noga Tarnopolsky again.
That is a clear line aimed at Netanyahu, and if he were to decide to take that sort of retaliatory action, he is risking what is evidently Israel's most important strategic asset, which is this relationship with the United States. I think it would be dangerous to do so, but I can't say what he will do.
Also unclear how the latest developments will impact the war in Gaza. Despite a recent drawdown of Israeli troops in the southern part of the Strip, the Israeli military says it will soon call up two reserve divisions for what it described as operations in Gaza. Margaret Evans, CBC News, London.
The United States says its support for Israel remains ironclad, but U.S. President Joe Biden does not support any retaliation. Biden convened a meeting of G7 leaders to create a unified response. Sasha Petrasik is in Washington with more on how the world is responding to developments in the Middle East.
No, it truly was unprecedented. It's a good word that you use there.
During the rounds of American political shows this morning, the U.S. administration denounced Iran's attack and praised Israel's military defenses. U.S. National Security Advisor John Kirby said American forces also shot down several dozen Iranian drones or missiles.
Our commitments aren't clad to defending Israel.
But Washington is walking a fine line, with President Joe Biden telling Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in a phone call that the U.S. will not take part in any military retaliation by Israel, advising Netanyahu not to do it.
We don't seek a wider war in the region. We don't seek a war with Iran.
Indeed, says retired U.S. Colonel Peter Mansour, no one does.
And so if Israel wants a war with Iran, it's going to find itself alone in that conflict. And I don't think that would be wise strategically, politically, or diplomatically.
That was the message after G7 leaders held an emergency video call this morning, including Canada's Justin Trudeau. The EU's Ursula von der Leyen summed up reaction to Iran's attack.
Today, we, the leaders of the G7, condemned this in the strongest terms.
But there was a message for Israel, too.
All parties should exercise maximum restraint.
Washington has no official relations with Iran, but it is using back channels and Mideast governments to deliver that message to Iran as well. Turkish sources say their government passed along a warning from Tehran before the attack was launched and sent a U.S. response to keep it within certain limits. Gulf diplomats say the U.S. is also using Arab states to pressure Iran. Jordan and Saudi Arabia saw Iranian drones and missiles in their skies and shot some down, says the Jordanian prime minister. With Israel contemplating its next move, Canada's ambassador to the UN, Bob Rae, says its leaders have a responsibility to listen to world concerns, chiding them for not doing so when they launched an attack on Iran's consulate in Damascus 2 weeks ago, which preceded yesterday's move by Tehran.
Nobody was consulted prior to the decision to launch the attack in Syria against the Iranian leaders. So I think it is time for Israel to realize they're not in this alone.
The Middle East is on the brink.
This afternoon, the UN Security Council took up the issue at Israel's request, with Secretary General Antonio Guterres attempting to put the brakes on further conflict.
Now is the time to defuse and de-escalate.
All eyes are on Israel for the next move. Sasha Petrasik, CBC News, Washington.
And while the world waits to see what happens next between Israel and Iran, Israel's war with Hamas continues in the Gaza Strip. Since January, more than 150 wounded Palestinians have been taken in by Italy, where they've had medical care and support. Italy is so far the only European country to do so. But those Palestinians are in Italy on temporary visas, which expire soon. As Megan Williams reports from Rome, that's forcing some of them to make a difficult choice.
Inside a community center in a former slaughterhouse in the south of Rome, people crowd around tables, chatting and laughing as they dig into platefuls of golden rice with chicken, cashews and raisins. Despite people hobbling on crutches or coping with other injuries, it's a joyful moment. The first time these injured Palestinians and family members have all met since they came by ship or plane to Italy earlier this year. People like 28-year-old Doa, who sits in a wheelchair next to her mother. She scoops up hummus with some pita using her left hand. Through an interpreter, she tells me she lost her other hand and a leg late last year, when the Israeli military dropped a bomb on her house. She pulls out her cell phone and swipes to a photo of two smiling young girls. These two are deceased, the interpreter tells me in Italian, killed in the bombing. Doa was 5 months pregnant and lost that child too, he says. Her other two daughters, she recently found out, are alive, now with their father in Rafah in southern Gaza, where hunger is widespread. Doa and the others say they're grateful that Italy brought them here and provided essential medical care. But their humanitarian visas last only 3 months. If they want to stay longer, they'll have to request asylum. And that worries the Palestinians. Some members of the Israeli government have called for rebuilding settlements in Gaza, even though Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel has no intention of permanently occupying the Strip.
And we are insisting that, you know, our nationality is a red line,
says Palestinian ambassador to Italy Abir Odeh. She wants Italy to ensure that with any offer of asylum comes the right of Palestinians to keep their passport.
The right of return of the Palestinian is very important to us. We want them to keep their passports, to get back to Palestine, to Gaza, whenever they finish their treatment here.
Odeh says the embassy is negotiating with the Italian government to come up with a solution similar to that offered to Ukrainians, who could extend their 3-month visas without becoming refugees. In the meantime, NGO workers say almost half of the injured Palestinians here in Rome have requested asylum, albeit reluctantly, because after 3 months, it's the only way to access social services. Longtime Rome resident and Palestinian doctor Youssef Salman says he's frustrated with the Italian government's failure to grasp the importance of the issue. While refugee status can be reversed, he says once most people settle in a new place, few return. Even Doa, waiting for a prosthetic leg, says her biggest desire now is to bring her surviving daughters and husband here to Italy. Megan Williams, CBC News, Rome.
Still ahead in the podcast, the Winnipeg Jets have been flying high this season, but the team's owner is looking even further than a Stanley Cup. He wants to revitalize Winnipeg's downtown core. We'll tell you how, coming up on Your World Tonight. It's been called the world's forgotten war. The conflict in Sudan has become one of the world's worst humanitarian disasters. More than 8.5 million people have fled their homes. Another 2 million have left the country altogether. And 1 year on, the vicious battle between two rival military factions shows no signs of letting up. Philip Lee Shannock reports.
In a refugee camp in Port Sudan on the Red Sea, 45-year-old Mashiar Ali says 1 year ago she could not imagine her life would be like this. From your home with a room to a place where you sleep on the floor, waiting for anything to eat, she says. It's been a year since the Sudanese armed forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces began openly fighting in the streets of Khartoum. Their struggle for power fed by long-standing ethnic and political tensions. Close to 16,000 people have been killed and millions displaced.
Every hour, a child in Zamzam camp in El Fasher, North Darfur, dies from malnutrition.
Edem Worsornu is with the UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. She says conditions are difficult for more than 8 million people who are internally displaced.
Rape, torture, murder, name it. What is happening in Sudan is an outrage. It's a moral outrage that it continues unabated.
Almost 2 million people have fled to neighboring countries, Egypt, Chad, and South Sudan. Safa Abdul Mutaleb roasts her coffee in her tent in Renk, South Sudan. It was very, very difficult for a long period. We were hiding under our beds. No food, no water, no help, she says. Filippo Grandi, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, warns of shortages of medicine, equipment, and staff. And he says aid organizations in the region are only getting a fraction of what is needed.
One of the worst displacement and humanitarian crises in the world, and one of the most neglected.
Canada announced this week that it is committing $132 million in humanitarian funding. International Development Minister Ahmed Hussein says the aid will help those facing famine-like conditions.
Shelter, water, and sanitation services. That's what this funding will enable us to continue to provide.
Andy says Canada will have a presence at an international conference in Paris this week aimed at restarting ceasefire talks between the warring parties in Sudan. The United Nations says it will use the opportunity to warn the world that humanitarian aid is lacking and that Sudanese refugees will join the flood of people looking to flee to more stable regions if help doesn't arrive. Philip Lee-Shannock, CBC News, Toronto.
In northwestern Nigeria, people are also marking a grim anniversary. It's been 10 years since 276 girls were kidnapped from their school in Chibok. Dozens are still missing, their families still hopeful they will reunite with the girls one day. Since the Chibok kidnappings, mass abductions by armed men, especially of school children, have become more common in Nigeria. Freelance reporter Ajek Mangut has more.
We have not heard anything about the missing girls.
Rebecca Samuel's daughter Sarah is among dozens of the abducted Chibok girls who are still missing. Rebecca says she's pained that her daughter has not been released a decade after she was kidnapped along with over 200 girls.
It's as if they have been forgotten. The realization that it has been 10 years weighs heavily on our hearts. Every day we pray fervently for her safe return.
10 years on, 185 of the girls have been rescued, released, or they escaped on their own. There are 91 girls that are still in abduction.
Buki Shonibare was at the forefront of the Bring Back Our Girls movement, which has been pushing for the rescue of the Chibok girls since 2014.
We occupied, we sat in places, we sat in we did all sorts just to make sure that that issue did not go under. The fact that all the girls were not brought back is failure of government. The Bola Tinubu administration still has the opportunity to make a public commitment that they are going to do everything within their power and influence to make sure that all of the Chibok girls are brought back.
Since the Chibok kidnapping, Nigeria has witnessed more mass abductions of students. The kidnapping of over 130 students in Kuriga, Kaduna State in March is the latest. Boko Haram, which has operated in Nigeria's northeast for over a decade, was responsible for the Chibok abductions. But over the years, more groups have emerged who see it as a lucrative business to make fast money. These abductions are blamed largely on the current economic challenges that have forced people to pick up arms.
The non-kinetic approach, unfortunately, has not been fully utilized by our security apparatus.
Salis Abdussalam is a security expert. He says the government should enhance its intelligence units to rescue kidnapped victims and also stop these abductions.
The government needs to galvanize the citizenry to own this fight and fight on the side of government, not allow it to be for the citizenry to continue to look at the fight as a security fight.
The previous administration of President Muhammadu Buhari failed to fulfill its promise to rescue the remaining Chibok girls. The current administration is focused on addressing the insecurity problem across the country and rescuing all kidnapped victims. Security experts have argued that because armed gangs use kidnapped victims as human shields, it has made military offensive in volatile areas a bit difficult. While the world may have moved on from the Chibok kidnappings, the victims' families say hope is what keeps them going.
The hope that we have is that as long as the girls are alive, we can meet again, no matter how long it takes.
But no one knows when that will be. Ajek Mangut for CBC News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Jury selection begins in New York tomorrow in Donald Trump's criminal trial, a first for a former U.S. president. Trump is facing 34 felony counts of falsifying business records in connection with allegations he paid hush money to adult film star Stormy Daniels. It's one of four criminal indictments against Trump. The cases surrounding classified documents in Florida and election interference in Georgia have no trial dates set. Trump has pleaded not guilty to all charges.
Here in Canada, the federal budget will be unveiled Tuesday, and with it comes promises to tackle the housing crisis without raising the deficit. But exactly how the government plans to pay for tens of billions of dollars in new spending is not yet clear. JP Tasker now on why that commitment leaves Ottawa with few options.
It's been tough because I like living in Kitchener. I like living
Ontario's
in Ontario,
red-hot housing market pushed millennial Mark Wittig to move.
Easily half the price of in Red Deer compared to Kitchener.
Cheaper homes in Alberta pulled this 26-year-old IT worker away from the place he's always called home.
A lot of it is housing affordability and finding a decent place that's not in sort of, well, for lack of a better term, sketchier areas.
The Liberals are promising Tuesday's federal budget will be packed full of housing measures to appeal to younger voters like Wittig.
We can dramatically scale the pace of home building in this country.
Housing Minister Sean Fraser says it will include releasing more public land to build nearly 4 million homes in 7 years.
We need to make it easier to build homes, and we need to change the way that we build homes if we're going to meet this goal.
The government has already announced some $38 billion in new spending before the budget's release, including $17 billion in loans. Figuring out how to pay for all this, that's the next challenge. Parliamentary Budget Officer Yves Giroux.
With the announcements we've heard recently, it leaves very little room to do that without increasing taxes.
RBC says Canada's AAA credit rating is at risk as Ottawa piles on more spending, saying in a report, Canada is at a greater risk of a downgrade than other top-rated peers. Robert Asselin used to work for the Liberal government. The senior vice president of policy at the Business Council of Canada says they need to get their fiscal house in order.
They continue to commit to spending that is not sustainable, and so they have no choice but to raise revenues.
James Thorne follows federal spending for a Bay Street firm.
Yeah, let's be honest, they have to raise taxes. I mean, how else are we going to do this? I don't think that it should be a big secret.
Axe the tax! Axe the tax!
Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre says he won't stand for a tax increase.
We believe that a dollar in the hands of the person who earned it is always more powerful than in the hands of the politician who taxed it.
But Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland suggested it's only the wealthy who could be out of pocket.
We remain absolutely committed to being there for hardworking middle-class Canadians, and we won't raise taxes on them.
It's not clear how this government defines the middle class. Just who might have to pay more is expected to be revealed on Tuesday. JP Tasker, CBC News, Ottawa.
Now, many Canadian athletes are gearing up for the Paris Olympics this summer. Paige Crozon is one of them. She's a basketball star with a juggling act, balancing her career with being a single mom. Erin Collins found out how she's keeping the balls in the air.
Like any good team, communication is key.
Do you need me to hold it for you?
It may not sound like it, but this is part of Olympic hopeful Paige Crozon's daily training routine. Preparing lunch for her daughter, Poppy.
Yeah, let's go, girl.
A 5-year-old Poppy helping to keep her mom moving. This single parent focused on getting to the Olympics in Paris. Her daughter along for the ride every step of the way, even in the gym.
Land it!
Now, Paige hopes to represent Canada in 3-on-3 basketball at this summer's Olympic Games. Poppy happy to pitch in to help her mom achieve her dream.
So, like, one hand at the bottom and the other hand on the side, and then frog, draft neck. Nice.
Paige juggling being a parent with working on her shooting.
So what's harder, making a three-point shot or being a single mom?
Well, I've probably taken about 50,000 three-point attempts in my career, and it's my first time being a single mom, so definitely being a single mom.
A technicality kept Paige from getting to the last Olympics, the first for 3-on-3 basketball. Poppy was there, too, helping to provide perspective.
Coming home to Poppy, and she comes and runs up and gives me a big hug, and then she tells me about the scrape on her knee, and that's the biggest thing in her world.
Now the push is on to get to Paris. Paige and her teammates prepping to play in a qualifying tournament in May. Teammate Casey Bosch confident in their chances.
We just need to get our reps in and get our flow, and we'll be set. We have so many great pieces, and we'll figure it out.
The entire team, including veteran Catherine Plouffe, encouraged by the development of its smallest member.
It's been really cool because we've seen Poppy grow for the last 5 years as she started playing 3x3, like literally from birth, you know. So.
And win or lose, the real lessons learned on this court have little to do with basketball.
Find something that you love, something that you're passionate about. Find a great group of friends and a community within that, and then do that for as long as you can at whatever level you choose.
Back at the gym, Paige and Poppy are already winning, learning to sink baskets and tie shoes along the way.
Sometimes if you make bigger bunny ears, it is a little bit easier, but whatever your preference is. And around, yeah, girl!
Erin Collins, CBC News, Lethbridge.
That's a very well-known tune for French Canadians, Quand on est en amour, in English, When We Are in Love, by Quebec country singer Patrick Normand. The song is 40 years old this year. It's also the focus of a new documentary about its significance far beyond Quebec, in Rwanda.
Everybody here in the French part of Canada, they know that song.
That's director Charles Domingue, speaking on CBC Radio's All in a Weekend. He says Patrick Normand first heard about his song's Rwanda connection when a woman came up to him in a restaurant and told him about one of her memories from the 1994 genocide.
She told him, "Thank you, you saved my life one day." And he was so surprised. "What? I saved your life? How come?" Say, "Yes, during the genocide, your song was very popular and it gave me hope, healed my heart, and thank you." And then she just disappeared.
That was more than two decades ago. The encounter stayed with Normand until he was finally able to go to Rwanda with the help of Domingue. There, they found people everywhere were familiar with the song. In a Kigali record shop, they spot a Patrick Normand vinyl, and when he starts singing, everyone in the shop joins in.
This song, it seems so simple, the lyrics, the words, but then it's maybe in simplicity that it's more profound.
Domingue's documentary screened at Montreal's Vieux d'Afrique Festival this weekend. We'll leave you with a little more of the song that inspired it on Your World Tonight, this Sunday, April 14th. I'm Stephanie Skenderis. Thanks for listening. Ne laisse pas passer la chance d'être aimé. Le cœur devient moins.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.